ladies and gentlemen.
Severus, please.
Avada Kedavra.
The Epic Film Guys Podcast. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another very special, very late spotlight in our Harry Potter spotlight series. This time we're talking about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. I, of course, am Nick.
And I'm Justin, and we, of course, are joined by our Harry Potter specialist himself, the know-all, be-all expert on all Harry Potter lore, the god of podcasting.
Hey!
I say it as I see it.
Well, yeah, I've read all the books, I've watched all the movies 15,000 times, and we're going to be talking about the most boringest one today.
You got that right.
If you haven't checked out the other entries into our Spotlight series, of course, Justin's our Potter newbie, never read any of the books, never watched any of the films until, well, most of the films until we watched through them in this series. I've seen all the movies, I adore them, and Loisos, of course, as he said, has read the books, seen the movies a million times, and we're going to bring the thunder, baby. We're going to bring the excitement, the just fast-paced, incredible action here to you. Mostly the opposite of what this movie does.
So I guess to bring people up to speed, so this is Harry's sixth year at Hogwarts. And Harry and Dumbledore are working in tandem as Voldemort's grip tightens on the wizarding world and now the muggle world. The movie opens on this very exciting sequence in which the Millennium Bridge is destroyed by Death Eaters. It kicks the movie off, kind of tricks you into thinking that you're going to be watching an awesome action movie. but you see the bridge collapse and people running and screaming, and it is a very exciting way
to kick
off the movie.
Very impressive sequence. I literally was in awe. I'm like, oh man, is this going to finally be that one Harry Potter movie that blows me out of the water? And then I watched the rest of the movie.
Now, again, directed by David Yates, returning for his second entry in the franchise. And obviously, we will get to see a lot more of Yates as we continue forward with Deathly Hallows and, of course, into Fantastic Beasts. But we mentioned this, I think, previously when we did another one of these spotlights, that for whatever reason, this film is almost impossibly dark in terms of its lighting, in terms of the way that the film is shot. There are even some sequences that dip into black and white, but the whole thing is drained of color so much that it's almost like distracting when you're watching it. I don't know how you guys felt about that, but I think we have to talk about it because it's one of the most prevailing things about this film. It's incredibly devoid of life and color.
I mean, there are some exceptions. We see early on the Weasley twins, Fred and George, have their joke shop, and that is appropriately jovial and colorful. And then, of course, we have Luna Lovegood wearing those ridiculous glasses that she's wearing. Those, I guess they're like 3D glasses, but anyway, so that brings some color early on, but the rest of the film is shot in almost like sepia tones.
Yeah.
And as Nick said, almost black and white. The cinematography here is very drained. I guess the reasoning for that is they wanted to convey that this is getting into the dark chapters. I think, Nick, you described it well when you said it's the coming storm, you know, of what's to come.
Before we talked recorded here, I mentioned that. And I really think that that's exactly what this film is intended to be. It's the coming storm. Voldemort is kind of placing his final pieces into place, as it were, to make his full-out assault on the wizarding world. And I really think that the tone in this film is meant to convey that. It's just, they're always, for one of the things that I think this film does extremely well, even though it is a very, very slow film and there's not a lot of action, the film is very, very looming. There is something looming at all times. The entire time you're watching this, you always feel like there's just something there looming in the background. And of course, that's just the presence of Death Eaters, of darkness, of Lord Voldemort himself, which of course will culminate in Deathly Hallows. But
right, because Voldemort himself is nowhere to be found in this installment. Ralph Fiennes is not in this film. So this, I think what this movie lacks, even though there is a sense that we're building towards something, is the threat, the immediate threat of a villain.
And that's what I wanted to ask over to Justin is do you feel that that was effective in what it was kind of trying to convey?
Well, there is one sequence here where we actually have bad guys encompassing bad things for our heroes, but it comes and it goes very quickly and it's very lackluster. It's when they come down, they attack the Weasley's home, and I was like, oh, cool, something good's going to happen. And then they like just run off, basically. And then that's the end of that. So, I mean, I think there is a strong feeling of evil throughout the film, however, because right in the opening of the movie, something is revealed to us. And me, this being my first time watching it, I was like, no. I mean, I kind of thought it was happening. I kind of thought it was there all along. But we find out that Snape is actually in disguise, basically. He's basically a bad guy pretending to be a good guy. And
he's a double agent.
Yeah, he makes a deal that he will carry out an evil plan in this movie.
The Unbreakable Vow, which once again have to highlight how much I love Helena Bonham Carter as Bellatrix Lestrange in these movies. She is so deliciously evil, and the film doesn't necessarily miss. I mean, you got to see him, of course, in Order of the Phoenix with that huge showdown with Dumbledore, but it doesn't necessarily miss Voldemort because everybody around him, like all the Death Eaters, they're so menacing. Especially Lestrange. She's just amazing. She's just amazing.
Yeah, I think one of the missed opportunities, just speaking as a fan of the book, is they introduce Greyback in this film, who is a Death Eater werewolf, and that's like the coolest thing ever. But you never see him transform, and he doesn't really do much. He attacks the burrow along with Lestrange, but I guess they retreat because they're outnumbered, but then that begs the question, like, why don't they just send, like, all the Death Eaters at once to go attack the burrow get Harry?
Honestly, it feels to me in this film that it's just kind of Voldemort slowly chipping away at, like, whatever good things or whatever things that the Aurors have at their disposal, like any safe havens that they might have. And we'll see that continue, obviously, into Deathly Hallows as he continues to try to shore up his power. That's really what that scene feels like to me. I think that's a great scene. I absolutely love that scene. And it is kind of a bright, it's fire, so there's actually some bright colors that we get to see in it. It is a brighter spot that kind of pops up in the middle of the film. But Justin's right. It's preceded by and then followed by long, long stretches of very, very slowly developing plot. And
which I'm okay with because, I mean, this movie is front-loaded with a lot of information that they have to convey.
Yeah.
We have to learn about Voldemort's childhood. We have to learn about the Horcruxes, which are essentially, we learn that Voldemort has split his soul into 7 pieces to make him harder to kill because he craves that power because, you know, he wants to live forever, essentially. So the way you split your soul is to murder people, and that makes for a very threatening villain. But again, there's no immediate threat. This movie is a lot of Harry learning about necessarily where Voldemort came from and how to potentially kill him. But that doesn't make for very exciting experience for the audience. What it does bring us, however, is a lot of great scenes between Harry and Dumbledore. I think Daniel Radcliffe, again, he's not given a whole lot to chew on here as he's on the receiving end of a lot of this information. Yeah. But Michael Gambon as Dumbledore, this is, I complained about his performance a little bit in the Goblet of Fire review, but here, I mean, this is where he truly embodies the character and becomes the Dumbledore that we hate to see go.
Yeah, and I think this film also introduces us to Horace Slughorn, played by Jim Broadbent, who I adore. I adore this character, and I mean, you've got to know right from the get-go that something is going to happen with Snape as you get through the film, because he's made the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, a position which never lasts more than a year for anybody in it at Hogwarts. So it immediately, as if the Unbreakable Vow and all that wasn't enough, it's like playing with its own mythology of like, well, he's going to be the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, so we know he's not going to be around.
Right.
But I adore Jim Broadbent, and I love his performance in this film. I love how kind of bumbling and whimsical he is, but there's also a little bit of a darkness and a mystery to his character.
He's almost, to me, he's almost adorable. He's kind of a really cute character, I thought. And that's a really weird way to describe him, but I was like, oh, he's just kind of cute. Like the opening when Dumbledore takes Harry to meet him and they try to convince him to come back to teach at Hogwarts again. I thought that was a really interesting sequence, and I thought it was a very charming character. I thought right off
he's
the bat.
Just he's disguised as a recliner.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do love this character because you get the sense that he is really a benevolent character, that he really does care about his students. But there's also a little bit of darkness to his character because, as we learn, he gives Voldemort the information, young Voldemort, the information that he needs in order to split his soul and create these Horcruxes. So,
yeah, which drives a large portion of the plot, as we get to see early a memory between Slughorn and Tom Riddle, of course, young Voldemort, wherein
played by Ralph Fiennes' nephew, actually, Hero Fiennes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I did not know that, but it's a very, very nice scene. But of course, as Dumbledore says, it's been manipulated with. It's not a true memory. And a large portion of this plot is trying to get close enough to Slughorn in terms of Harry to get that memory out of him. And I think those scenes are always really great. I think that Radcliffe and Broadbent play really, really well off of each other. And those are some of my favorite scenes in this film.
Especially when Harry's on the Felix Felicis, the basically liquid luck.
Yeah.
A lot of the humor comes from Harry's kind of reactions to things and him trying to get the information that he needs. That is great character building, I think, for the Slughorn character, because he feels tremendous guilt. And it's almost like he's lied to himself about...
He's almost convinced himself about it, yeah.
Exactly. I think all of that stuff is really well done. There is a lot of humor in the film, a lot of character stuff that I think works really well in the film. Since we're not getting huge action scenes, we are getting quieter character moments. This is a much, I feel, smaller scale movie. I mean, we just saw in Order of the Phoenix, we just saw an all-out wizard battle, wand duels, and tremendous set pieces.
You can't follow up Order of the Phoenix with that big battle, especially knowing in Deathly Hallows is the battle of battles. It's like the end of everything. I don't think you can follow up Order of the Phoenix with having another one, because by the time you get to Deathly Hallows, it's just like, all right, fine.
I just would have preferred at least a skirmish, like something. Give me a taste of something, because as you just said, that's one of the most disappointing things about this movie to me, is that there really aren't any great action sequences. Now we see another Quidditch match or tryouts, right? They're trying out. It's a tryout. Right,
we see a Quidditch match in this film.
Okay.
You know, Ron's
trying out to be the keeper, or as I'd like to call it, he's a fucking goalie. Okay, he's a goalie. Yep. Whatever. But there's some excitement to be had there. But like up until the ending, there's some really dry spots for me, and there's great character building. But for me, I want some of those pieces of those earlier movies where there's some really exciting things to happen, and that doesn't really happen that much in this movie at all. So it was really hard for me personally to keep my attention.
Well, one of my favorite action sequences in this film, I do want to talk about some of the action in this film because I think there's some good stuff. And we can't talk about this film without talking about Tom Felton, of course, as Draco Malfoy. But he and Harry have this amazing and kind of really brutal duel where Harry uses a curse on him at the end of it and like messes Draco up something fierce.
Almost
like,
kills
by the end
him.
Of it. Yeah. Like it's.
Yeah.
That's like that to me, like the film's peppered with those little moments. I don't think they come enough. I agree with Justin that there should have been a little bit more here and there, but like there's moments like that, especially like Loisos was talking about with character building. Amazing, because we've seen Harry and Draco just kind of go at each other, but they've never like full on
so many
like,
times, yeah.
thrown down. Like they had a duel in one of the films, and it they go at each other verbally mostly, but this time they legit throw down.
Mm-hmm. You see blood in a Harry Potter movie. Like, I mean, he's basically Malfoy's covered in blood. And I mean, it is a PG rated film. After the last two were PG-13, this is PG. I would have liked to have seen more blood, because the way she describes it in the book, Rowling describes it in the book, is much even bloodier than what we saw on screen. But it is awesome. And we do get an amazing entrance from Snape. When Snape comes in, the way that scene is framed with him, when he comes in and he looks over Malfoy on the ground, his cape, just like the way it billows and there's like smoke everywhere and the lights coming in through the window. It's like really well done. And Snape is especially intimidating in that moment. because he's figured it out that Harry knows the spell that he created. Whoops, spoiler. Yeah, Professor Snape does turn out to be the Half-Blood Prince, which the Half-Blood Prince, Harry discovers this this textbook.
The tattered old textbook, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the Half-Blood Prince has written in the margins and kind of given him hints to perform well in his potions class.
And that's how he wins the liquid luck that you're referring to, yeah.
Which helps him earn favor with Professor Slughorn. So you can tell that Rowling planned all this stuff out, and it is a very tight plot because there is a lot of mystery because there are these cursed items that are throughout the film, and you're wondering like who's cursing these items and for what purpose. It's really well done the way that it all ties together in the end.
The film reaches its climax. Harry and Dumbledore find another one of Voldemort's Horcruxes, so they travel to this cave where they have to take a boat across this water, and there's just this little weird crystalline structure. I love the production design in this entire scene, and it's got some great moments, especially like you were talking about earlier, Loisauce, between Harry and Dumbledore, where Dumbledore, you know, tells Harry, do not stop me, I have to drink all of this liquid that's in there. No matter what happens, you have to make me drink all of it, no matter how much I beg.
Yeah, even if I beg, even if I, you know, screaming and suffering, just keep feeding me this liquid. There's a tremendous sadness to it because you get the sense that Dumbledore is suffering, but they have to complete this task in order to get to the Horcrux. And then these creatures appear that try to drag Harry down.
And that is one of the most impressive visuals of this whole movie.
For sure.
I knew when I rewatched this movie, because it's definitely a lot of good horror elements. They're horrific, whatever the hell they are, creatures.
Yeah, what are they anyway?
They're, in theory, they're basically like zombies. They're all like deformed and they crawl out. I would have preferred if they were practical as opposed to CGI.
Well,
but that's just personal preference. Yeah.
That would have reminded me of The Descent if they looked practical.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Definitely.
I think the best part about that scene, though, is Michael Gambon's performance, because he really, really sells kind of the agony. I mean, he's drinking water, but somehow he's able to convey that is like legitimately every sip of it is like tearing him apart inside. And I really, really, really love his performance in that scene.
Yeah. And of course, the way Dumbledore gets rid of the Inferi, he has this amazing, like, basically like this flamethrower spell. And it's freaking awesome. That image of Dumbledore and the fire like cascading around him is incredibly impressive. And it's a nice burst of color after that scene is literally, it's a black and white sequence for all intents and purposes.
Like completely black and white, yeah.
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 So then meanwhile, like throughout the entire film, there's this whole subplot of Draco Malfoy with this vanishing cabinet.
Right, right.
That, you know, we kind of keep returning to it, and you can't really tell exactly what's going on, but you know, because he goes to a vanishing cabinet in the Room of Requirement, he puts an apple in it, he puts a bird in it. You could tell, at the very least, that he's trying to create some kind of connection to the outside. We see him early in the film, you know, going to Borgin and Burke's, and we see shots of another vanishing cabinet there, and you know, the film reaches its climax where we learn that he's basically created a doorway from Borgin and Burke's to Hogwarts, because we see at different times in the film, we see the Death Eaters trying to attack Hogwarts, but there's this big protective, like magical spell around it where they can't penetrate it. They can't get in through the outside because the magic's just way too powerful. So they have to find a way to kind of sneak inside. And that's when, you know, Harry and Dumbledore apparate back from the cave, and Dumbledore tells Harry, he says, whatever happens, no matter what happens, go down below and don't come up, don't interfere, don't do anything, no matter what happens. And now we see Draco enter the room, and I love, love, love Tom Felton's performance in this scene. He does not get enough opportunities throughout like the entire rest of the series, really, to kind of flex his chops a little bit. And it's tearing him apart because he, of course, has been instructed to kill Dumbledore. And, you know, he can't do it. Like, he just can't do it. It's literally tearing him apart.
this is where you start to sympathize with Malfoy a little bit as a character, because he's been given this task that he's not, you know, he doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
And it's kind of tearing him up inside. And earlier on in the series, he's such a little shit. You just want to see him get his in the end.
I wanted to see him murdered. I wanted to see him dismembered. I wanted to see him hung.
Did you want to see a kid get stabbed?
I wanted to see him get stabbed.
I want to see kid get stabbed.
There it is.
There we go. But you kind of sympathize with him a little bit here, because you can tell he, you know, he has a little bit of good inside of him. And it comes through in his performance. Tom Felton, this is really his moment to shine.
It's a heartbreaking scene, because you really do dial into the conflict within the character. And then, now, for me, and I don't know, Loisos, well, you read the books, obviously, so I've got to ask Justin, did you know what was going to happen in the scene before it happens?
No, I did not know.
See, for me,
I had no idea.
This comes back to when the book was initially released. Way back when the book was released, people, trolls really, would go to book releases and they would drive by, like tons of people waiting in line to buy the Half-Blood Prince, and they would just shout out the window, "Snape kills Dumbledore," and take off like a bat out of hell and ruin the plot twist for people.
Yeah.
And I found out, because I hadn't read the books, and at that point in my life, I didn't care about Harry Potter, so I read about it online. Like, so many people were so angry because the twist in this movie is, of course, that's his unbreakable vow. If Draco can't complete the job, then Snape has to step in. And even knowing that when you watch the scene, like, you just see Dumbledore turns to Snape and he just says, "Severus, please," and then boom, killing curse, and he's out the window. And the shot of Dumbledore, no matter how bad the rest of this movie is, no matter how slow the rest of this movie is, that is one of the most haunting and just horrible shots in the entire franchise.
My jaw was dropped during that. I don't know if Brian looked at me, but I didn't expect that to happen. So when it happened, I was like, he's not really dead, right? And then you just looked at me and you were like, did your whole like, he's kind of dead. And I was like, no, he can't die. Because I don't know anything about these movies. I don't know about the books and nothing. So I'm like, he's not dead. He's got to come back. I was like, oh, he's fucking dead. So yeah, it was definitely an emotional scene.
That scene, just like that shot, you know, after he does the killing curse and then Dumbledore just plummeting from the tower. And then meanwhile, Snape and Malfoy and the Death Eaters escape. And I love, this is why I love Harry Potter, like the character of Harry Potter. Like, legit doesn't care, goes after Snape to do whatever the hell he can, like screaming at him, trying to stop him, trying to throw spells at him. And, you know, that's when, of course, Snape reveals that he was the Half-Blood Prince the entire time.
I have a question about this scene, though, because I do have a slight problem with it. Is it that he's so blinded by his agony and being sad and angry about Dumbledore's passing that he can't actually really defend himself? I'm like, it's another one of those things as these movies continue on. I'm like, I've seen you do so much more than this. I've seen you actually, you know, like awesome spells and you're more powerful than this. I'm like, how are you not doing more than this? How are you not actually giving Snape a run for his money or actually being able to injure him or do anything to him? It's just, am I wrong there? Like, should I not be thinking that? I'm like, oh yeah, you're just like falling on the ground. You just keep getting blasted down. So I guess I should take it as his pain is blinding him from being able to function properly.
I would probably say like that factors into it a little bit, but I mean,
there was no battle. He's just like, he lets him go. He goes, and that's the end of it. And he's like, okay, you know?
Yeah. See, I wonder if that, like, after Snape deflects, of course it's his own spell. And that's that's why Snape is like, you think you can use my own spell against me or whatever he says. But I think at that moment, I think that Harry just kind of realizes that there's a better way to go about things. And like, he's still, I think he's kind of remembering that, like, the bigger picture, like, they've still got 5 Horcruxes that are out there that need to be destroyed. And Voldemort's still out there. And, you know, I think he realizes that, like, at that point, especially because he's alone, and there's all the Death Eaters there. Like, Lestrange tries to kill him, and of course, Snape has to stop her, but he belongs to the Dark Lord.
Oh my God, that was one of the best impressions I've ever heard of Alan Rickman in my life.
I love it. But it's,
that's great.
I think it's Harry really also realizing that he can't, that he needs to fall back in this moment, even though, yeah, I think it's his rage and it's his anguish that kind of drives him to chase after him in the first place.
And also, there's a sequence that is in the book, but not in the movie, where a huge battle breaks out in Hogwarts. So you have students fighting Death Eaters, you have teachers fighting Death Eaters. It's like kind of like chaos once it's learned that Death Eaters are in the school. So this was cut out of the movie because David Yates, perhaps rightfully so, didn't want there to be repetition when we get the epic battle in the Deathly Hallows Part 2 at Hogwarts.
I think, so in terms of a film, though, I think the film has to end on Dumbledore's death. It can't have a huge set piece after Dumbledore's death.
After because his
that,
death,
for no. an audience perspective, watching a film, that death has to hang on you as you walk out of the theater. Like, if you have a big action spectacle after it happens, in terms of like watching a movie, the death isn't going to hang with you like it does when this movie ends.
Agreed. The book ends on Dumbledore's funeral, so it does kind of tie back to the loss of the character. But I don't know if they wanted to end the movie on a funeral. That's kind of that's not an extremely satisfying way to end your movie. But I understand why they made the choices that they did. But it seemed like the movie could have used a little bit more oomph at the end. We do get a very emotional scene where the students and professors mourn Dumbledore and shine their wands up in the air. And it's very symbolic because you see the dark mark in the sky, you see the giant skull and the snake slithering out, and all of their lights together kind of dispel that and bring lightness to the sky again. And
Coupled with Nicholas Hooper's incredible score for this film. I adore the score for this movie. And that scene always shatters me because the score swells. And like it's really like that score, like that piece. And they sample it earlier in the film too at different points. But it's really effective at just kind of conveying the weight of the loss of Dumbledore, especially like... This is like the one character, like especially after you see him legit throw down with Voldemort without even breaking a sweat in Order of the Phoenix, like he kind of gains this almost invincibility and you're like, well, Dumbledore's fine.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why when he died, I was like, he's not dead. How could this dude die?
Well, and also throughout the series so far, Harry has felt safe because of Dumbledore.
Yep.
You know, it goes all the way back to the first film where Hermione tells Harry, like, you know, with Dumbledore around, you can't be touched. And, you know, now that Dumbledore is dead, it kind of leaves Harry defenseless, seemingly, you know, because he had this mentor, this person who was always there for him.
This protector,
saves his ass in part 5. So now Harry's without that protection. And that kind of leads into Deathly Hallows parts 1 and 2, where it's like nowhere safe and Harry is ripe for the taking. I mean, we can see.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about Deathly Hallows 1 and 2, especially I don't want to get into that stuff while we're talking about this movie, but I can't wait to get into those two films.
We can also not forget, you know, Hermione and Ron in this movie. They do have a story arc for their characters as well. We see there's a deepening relationship between the two of them, and we see Ron getting a girlfriend. We see him like making out a lot in this movie, and it's PG. It's PG.
Lavender Brown is like, I love that character in this movie.
She's creepy as hell.
She is so creepy.
When they're eating and they look over and she's like staring at them. Dude, I knew that girl in high school. That girl was creepy. I know what that feels like. So, yeah, no, so there's that. And of course, and that's kind of like tying them up and doing their thing in the movie where, you know, Harry, of course, is wandering around and doing all of his.
We also get to see not only, you know, the kind of developing romance between Ron and Hermione, but also Harry and Ginny Weasley, which really, really love. Ginny Weasley is one of my favorite characters in the entire series. So I just, I love those moments.
Why is she one of your favorites?
I don't know. She's just got this niceness to her. She seems like she's good for Harry.
Because in the movies, there's like zero character development for her.
Yeah, she is. She doesn't get much of a character arc.
Are you saying you like how she looks? Are you saying you like to look at her when you watch these movies?
I'm saying they're cute. They're cute
together.
Is
she one of those spots in those movies? You're like, I can't wait to see that chick.
Do you like redheads, Nick?
They're cute together. Shut up.
Okay.
One of my favorite scenes of this movie is, I just have to say, when Ron takes the love potion That's one of the funniest scenes of the movie to me. I love that scene. When Harry goes up, I almost felt like there was a possibility of like an almost homosexual encounter between the two of them, because Ron sits down on the bed with Harry and he's like right in his face. I'm like, what's going to happen here? This is kind of really uncomfortable.
That would have been amazing.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's a love potion. The love potion doesn't tell you who you're supposed to love, does it? It just makes you want to love, right?
No, because the love potion was meant for Harry, and it was but it was from Romilda Vane, who had a crush on Harry. So Ron is suddenly obsessed with Romilda Vane, and so I do love that exchange, and you get a sense that these are real teenagers now, because when I was 16, you know, I was thinking about girls all the time.
Yeah, they are basically obsessed with you know, girls and boys, you know, respectively, pretty much through the whole movie. You don't get as much of it with Harry because he's got so much of the plot to shoulder as well, but you definitely
still get it. He makes out with Ginny. Yeah, he makes out with Ginny in that one scene. That's kind of very sweetly romantic, that moment where they're in the room of requirement together alone. She tells him to close his eyes. He does. She comes in. Like, that's very...
Such a nice moment. It really
nice.
And I really how you know, Emma Watson portrayed Hermione as like this really jealous girl in this movie. Very subtle, but very realistic in terms of how a girl is jealous when the boy that she likes, or the girl that she likes maybe, is with somebody else.
The moment where she kind of confides in Harry and kind of breaks down is heartbreaking. Yeah. And then when Ron rushes in, she conjures up like birds to help calm her down, I guess. And then when Ron and Lavender comes in, she sends the birds to attack him. I love that.
Smash against the door.
It's fantastic.
Oh my Lord. Yeah, there are some really, really good character moments in this film. All as usual with these films, I think knockout performances across the board. I love, especially Alan Rickman, I love seeing Snape finally get more to do. Like, he definitely gets some things to do in some of these films, but obviously he's going to play a much bigger part in Deathly Hallows 1 and 2 when we get there. But I love that he has like an actual plot arc himself in this film. Like, he actually has something he has to do. And I really, really love that. He remains just amazing.
It makes me so sad every single time I think of the back of my head, because I seem to forget, especially watching these movies. I think it's easier for me to remember when I watch Die Hard every Christmas season, that Alan Rickman has left this world. He's no longer with us. And it's really sad, because I feel like he really does, in these movies, when he gets the opportunity, really does flex his chops really, really greatly. And he's really, really good in these movies. And he's one of my favorite parts about these movies, I think. I just love his character. I love what he did with the character, the look and the voice and everything, as you did so wonderfully earlier. Nick, I hope I get to hear more of your Snape voice in the next two episodes.
Maybe. But the film ends. The film ends, of course, after we get all the nice emotional moments, just with a quiet moment with just our core trio, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, where Harry reveals that the Horcrux that he and Dumbledore had found was fake. And there's just a note
inside.
Which
is such a gut punch.
It's such a gut punch, because Dumbledore's dead. Like, you get to see that amazing scene of Dumbledore suffering just to try to get the Horcrux. And then all it is just a message from R.A.B., saying that he's stolen the real Horcrux. And then, it just kind of leaves you, Dumbledore's dead. They didn't find the Horcrux that they thought they had found. And now, like, really, this film ends on that kind of directionlessness. Like, you have no idea what these characters are going to do, where they're going to go, how they're going to possibly, especially without, like, their guiding hand, how they're going to be able now to defeat Voldemort, who are very much, I mean, like I said at the beginning, it's the coming storm. And by the time this movie gets to its end, like, getting rid of Dumbledore and being able to assault Hogwarts was a big part of Voldemort's plan. And now that can now happen as well. And I love where this film ends. I love the place it leaves these characters and this entire story in the end, because it really does like leave you with that like looming sense of holy shit, it's about to go down.
I can imagine being a fan in the theater watching this and being a fan of this series, as you were, Brian, watching each one of these movies in the theater as they were released and being left with that, oh my God, I have to wait to see what happens next. Like, it's a really great, not cliffhanger ending, but it really leaves you wanting more. Like, you're like, I want to see that adventure now. I want to see them off hunting for these Horcruxes, and it-
especially because everything that came before it was just kind of, again, it's kind of lackluster. Not a whole lot happens in Half-Blood Prince. There's a lot of information that you learn throughout, and you get a lot of great character moments as we've talked about. But it is frustrating when you watch this movie and you're just really wanting to get to that full course meal,
yeah,
that you don't really get in this film.
Yeah.
So I have problems with the ending, specifically the fact that Ron is like sitting off by himself while Hermione and Harry are, because I just feel like Ron should be more involved in like, yeah, we'll help you. Because he does in the book, he's there in the book. I've read reports that Rupert Grint had like the swine flu or something while they were filming that scene, so they didn't want him to get too close to the actors. But I'm like, come on, like, you know, I
Ron
think
Weasley
personally
would get the swine flu.
He looks like that. Rupert Grint looks like the kind of guy that would get the swine flu.
So let's, before we reveal.
I feel like Ron kind of takes a backseat in the movies in general, but especially in that last scene, you kind of want the three of them together Harry and Hermione off to themselves and Ron in the distance, but that does kind of foreshadow what's to come, so I won't say any more.
Yeah, so before we get to this week's trivia question, or this episode's trivia question, I guess, as it were, let's throw some quick number ratings on the film. We're going to start over with our Potter newbie. Saw this film for the first time as part of this whole Spotlight series that we're doing. Justin, put the number on it, baby.
Even though this movie is pretty boring in my eyes, I probably wouldn't go grab this one out of the entire series and say I want to rewatch this one again, compared to the rest. But I still thought it was good. I still thought, you know, the acting is brilliant. I think Dumbledore's death is very powerful. I love Snape's turn in the movie. Of everything that we discussed in this review, I agree with all your guys' points. I didn't hate anything about it. I just wish there was that one action sequence where I was like, yes, which I know there have been in the previous films that I really, really enjoyed that were done very, very well. So I'm going to give Half-Blood Prince a 7 out of 10 rating.
All right. And over to our Potter guru, as it were, Loisos.
I'm right there with Justin. This is probably my second least favorite of the series. It at least knows how to tell a story as opposed to Goblet of Fire. But even Goblet of Fire has a couple of those sequences that I'm just like, can't wait to get to.
Yeah.
And there's not really that one scene in Half-Blood Prince. So exactly. I concur with everything that Justin said. I do love the character moments. I do think this is one of the funniest films in the Harry Potter series.
Yep.
But it's very small scale, and it is kind of a slog to get through when I know what's coming.
Yeah.
So 7 out of 10 for me, Nick.
Yeah, I'm gonna say right in lockstep with you guys. It's a 7 out of 10. It's got all those good moments to it, but yeah, I think this is one of those let's watch the best moments on YouTube. Like you'll just pull up like your favorite scenes from it on YouTube and just watch those. Because I think that there's a lot in this film. Like they probably could have gone through this film and trimmed it back by like maybe 10, 15 minutes, and it would have overall made it a much, much more brisk feel, but that's not the film we got. But I'm glad that we got the character moments in it that we got, because there's so much that they have left to pay off in this series with Deathly Hallows, and I can't wait to get to those films in this series.
It's a crucial chapter for sure.
It really
is. Necessary. But it's not, it doesn't have the most entertainment value.
I liken it to Goblet of Fire. I think it's a much better film than Goblet of Fire is.
Oh, definitely.
I liken it to Goblet of Fire in that most of the film is just leading up to that one amazing scene. Like the scene in the tower is just incredible. It's beyond amazing. And it's super important to Harry Potter, like the series as a whole. But like getting through the rest of it is like... And it very much with Goblet of Fire with the graveyard scene, it's kind of similar in that regard where it's just like, well, we've got to get through the rest of this just so we can get to that graveyard scene. And yeah, so there we go. 7 out of 10s all around the board. Just a generalized recommendation, but definitely not the best film in the series by any regard. So Loisos, I'm going to kick it over to you. We've got a trivia question. Remember,
trivia.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can win digital copies of the entire
Harry Potter saga.
Harry Potter. All of them, all 8 films, and every single entry in the trivia contest that you answer correctly gets you 1 ticket in the virtual drawing. We've got a bunch of people who've got multiple entries already improving their chances of winning. But Loisos, let's drop some trivia on them right now.
Alrighty, so the trivia question for all 8 Harry Potter films on 4K Ultra HD digital.
What is that fucking voice he's doing?
It is my trivia voice. So, the question is, as we mentioned, there are 7 Horcruxes. 2 of them have already been destroyed by the time this film starts. What are they? So, again, for those of you who weren't listening, so there are 7 Horcruxes, 2 of which have already been destroyed by the time this film begins. What are those 2 Horcruxes?
Booyah. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're releasing this, the week before Fantastic Beasts come out. Fantastic Beasts, I've already got my
advance
tickets.
Fantastic Breasts.
Fantastic Beasts, the Crimes of Grindelwald. So I'm super excited. I'm super, super excited, even though I still have yet at this point in like my watching schedule to see the first one. So I've got to squeeze that in.
Nick, I'm really curious as to what you'll think of Fantastic Beasts.
I'm so excited to talk about it.
Cute animals. Cute creatures. You want to hold them and pet them and give them a big old kiss.
We got through that whole review without Justin mentioning Scabbers. I'm shocked.
I'm still angry. I would have preferred a Scabbers origin story than Fantastic Beasts.
Origin story. So yeah, this will drop on Monday the 12th. And then coming up next Monday the 19th, of course, we'll have already seen Fantastic Beasts 2, but we'll be dropping Deathly Hallows 1 and 2 on you Monday the 19th. And then, of course, our main episode on the 22nd will be Fantastic Beasts 1 and our full review of number 2, The Crimes of Grindelwald, which I'm just super excited. I love Harry Potter in general, so I love that this whole month of November is just kind of be immersed by it. I love it. I really, really can't wait.
And of course, if you have not participated yet, we are still doing our Never Seen It November challenge.
Baby.
If you are interested in that, only 10 movies that you haven't seen. That's right. Only 10 movies that you haven't seen. Come on over to the Hopesters Dumpster, our fan group, and check them in there. We have a pin post there for you guys to talk about the movies you're seeing.
It's absolutely, absolutely wonderful. So guys, this is it. After this, it's all about the Deathly Hallows, which I cannot wait to talk about. Deathly Hallows 1 was my first ever Harry Potter film that I ever saw.
That still blows my mind.
I can't wait to talk about that, and I can't wait to talk about all of it, but that's going to come next time. So until then, for myself, for the god of podcasting himself,
I want to see Kid get strangled.
Wow. And for Justin, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so, so, so much for listening. And as always,
we will see you
at the movies.
Harry Potter, Harry Potter.